From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Guy Raz. This episode, the housing recovery, maybe this time it's real.
So it's not just about buying space, it's about buying things to fill that space with.
All of Italy dines together.
We need to fall in love for Italy again. And this night can be the point to start.
And a trip down a Wisconsin river, the Bark.
You had all these villages for one reason, and it's because it was a very beautiful area to live.
Also, new music from singer Beth Orton. That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. Four years ago, an epic collapse in the housing market dominated the headlines.
Last month alone, more than 70,000 families lost their homes.
A growing list of Americans caught up in the housing crisis.
Foreclosures jumped a staggering 158%.
Schiller House Price Index recorded its first year-over-year decline.
220,000 homes were lost to bank repossessions in the second quarter. That's a lot of families.
At that time, nearly 11 million homes held more debt than value. Put together, that's just about the population of Ohio. So what to make of the trend now? Home prices are rising, mortgage rates are dropping. And the classic, the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, is at its lowest point since 1971. Our cover story today, the housing recovery. Maybe this time, it's real. When housing does well, it's the economic engine that pulls everything else behind it, more than manufacturing or autos. And here's why.
When you think about, all right, if I'm moving into an apartment, what do I do? Maybe I want a new television. And ooh, that's a nice couch that that person has on Craigslist. He's replacing it with another couch. I'll get that couch. So it's not just about buying space. It's about buying things to fill that space with. This helps to explain why when a housing unit is purchased or rented, it usually presages a lot more economic activity to come. And then other companies see that economic activity and they respond to it.
That's Derek Thompson, a senior editor at The Atlantic magazine who follows the housing market. That knock-on effect he's talking about is boosting stocks like Home Depot's and Lowe's. They're trading at their highest prices in a decade, and that's luring investors.
For instance, Lazy Boy is seeing its growth of about 8%. You know, when you get an economy that's growing at only 2%, those are the companies that we really like to own that are doing better than the overall economy.
That's Brian Peary of the California investment firm, the Hennessy Funds. He's optimistic.
I think we're actually just beginning a long-term cycle here. I think if you look at the home builders and the construction companies themselves, they're not quite optimistic yet, but they've certainly become less pessimistic.
Are real estate agents more optimistic? Victoria McCaskill certainly is. She sells homes in Denver.
What we're seeing now is low inventory. We're seeing lots of buyers in the marketplace. Rents are up, and we're seeing a situation where it's almost difficult to find a home as a buyer. It's a multiple bid situation in a lot of instances.
So less pessimism, more optimism. Still, a number of false starts in the economy over the past few years have fallen flat. This time, according to Derek Thompson, the growth is real, if halting.
If you look back over the last 30, 40 years, the thing that has really gotten the economy out of the dumps is big ticket items. And the two most important are housing and cars. In the early 1970s and in the mid-1970s, the recession that we had was cured by a recovery that was led by cars. Cars and houses accounted for 50% of the recovery in the 1970s. They accounted for a third of the recovery in the 1980s. And today they're accounting for only about 10% of the recovery. So we're missing this huge, important engine of economic growth.
So there are a number of indicators that economists are pointing us to as proof that the housing market recovery is kind of gaining steam. There's home prices, there's housing starts, there's many more. Which ones should we be focusing on?
You want to look at, are houses being built? What kind of houses are those? And so what you're looking for there are permits. Those say, all right, construction can begin here. And housing starts. That's where construction breaks ground. Because one of the reasons why this recovery has been so disappointing is because we overbuilt in what's called single-family houses. Those are the houses, you know, with a picket fence. We didn't have as many multifamily homes, which is sort of a fancy term for what I think the average person would just call an apartment complex. So right now what you see is you've seen an uptick in apartment buildings. building. And this is really important because what you've also seen over the last few years is a lot of young people living with their parents. But it seems like they might just now be starting to move out of their parents' basements. And they're not going to take, you know, their ratty sweatpants stuffed with $10,000 and put a down payment on a huge home. They're going to first move into apartments. And so hopefully, once we see enough of these apartment buildings being built, we'll sort of hit a ceiling in the apartment sector. And then you'll see people starting to move out of apartments and into houses. And then you'll really have the housing recovery that we're all waiting for.
So if a housing boom is a jobs creator, where are the booms the strongest? In what states and cities?
So for a long time in the recession, we had a term at The Atlantic we called Michicala Flarivada. Michigan, California, Florida, Arizona, and Nevada. And these were, if the housing crunch was an earthquake, these were the epicenters. And right now, in a lot of these cities, you're starting to see some real activity coming back. But really, as you look across the country, not everything is improving or declining at the same rate. But you know what? That looks less like a recession and more like just a regular economy.
We shouldn't forget, though, of course, that there are still thousands of homeowners struggling with foreclosure and struggling to repay mortgages and get them renegotiated.
Absolutely, right. At some point in this recession, one out of every five homeowners was underwater, owed more on their house than the house was worth. And so, you know, right now, I think there's a lot of people who are sort of waiting and hoping that if Romney is elected, if Obama is elected, that they'll have a kind of secret plan to replace the current strategy with proactive policies that say, we're going to make it easier for people to we understand how important housing is to a recovering economy, and we're going to make sure that 2013 doesn't look like 2009 through 2012.
But although the economy is the focus of this presidential race, jobs have gotten the attention. Housing hasn't come up.
The auto industry supports one in eight Ohio jobs. It's a source of pride to this state. It's a source of pride for generations of workers. I refused to walk away from those workers.
I want to champion small business. I want to make it easier for small businesses to grow and thrive. That means I want to keep the taxes down on business. I want our tax rates to be competitive with other nations. I want regulators to see their job as encouraging business, not attacking business, because I want more jobs. My priority is jobs, 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 and we're going to get them here in Ohio.
That's President Obama and Governor Romney sparring over jobs in swing state Ohio this week. Now, the auto industry recovery has created about 250,000 jobs, but there are 1 million real estate agents in this country. So given that housing is so huge, why aren't the candidates talking more about it, especially to those Americans still in crisis? We put the question to Bill Faith. He's the executive director of the nonprofit Coalition on Homelessness and Housing in Ohio.
You know, it perplexes me that it didn't come up in any of the debates when the collapse of the housing market was a large part of the reason we had the Great Recession to start with. So you would think we'd all want to stabilize the housing market faster. We'd want to see the housing market grow faster. And yet we've heard almost nothing from, you know, really either side.
So home prices are rising in many parts of the country, Bill. Contractors building new homes. And the big picture shows a national housing recovery, although a slow one. Why don't you describe the housing market for us in Columbus?
You got to remember, Ohio had 12 years of record levels of foreclosures before the recession even hit. But it has started to stabilize. In fact, the foreclosure numbers have declined in our market here in Columbus the last couple years. But there's still 30% of Ohioans that are underwater in their mortgage. You know, a two-bedroom apartment is still out of reach for many low-wage workers. I mean, people on minimum wage, people that are disabled. You have to have basically two full-time minimum wage jobs to afford the fair market rent on an apartment. So we still have many people that are struggling to meet their housing costs.
Do you see a clear choice, Bill Faith, in housing plans between the candidates?
You know, we've been disappointed in some of what the president did and some of what he didn't do when it came to housing. But they did try a number of things, and some of that paid off. You know, we did see a number of foreclosures get prevented because of some of the policies the Obama administration promoted. We haven't been totally satisfied by any means, but at least there's something there. On Governor Romney's side, he's more of a guy who talks about let the market play out. The other thing that Governor Romney has said to give us some idea of where he might go is when it comes to helping the lowest income people, those that are most vulnerable, he's talked about eliminating the very agency that works on those issues, and that's the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And I think no matter where people are at on this, housing is very important to us, and it's worthy of presidential attention.
Bill Faith of the Coalition on Homelessness and Housing in Ohio. As Americans await the election, there are still things holding buyers and investors back, whether the mortgage deduction will remain, for example. And Derek Thompson cautions there's still a couple of other tripwires out there.
So number one, I would say there's fear about what's happening in the rest of the world that sort of impacts the decisions that households and companies make in terms of buying new homes, getting new apartments, or building new homes and new apartment buildings. The second thing I would look at is Congress. Right now, the U.S. economy is recovering, the private sector at least, at a decent pace. What could really hold us back is that this do-nothing Congress does nothing again and lets the fiscal cliff happen. Actually, there was a CBO report that looked at, all right, if the fiscal cliff happens, how bad is the typical family going to feel it? And they said, we think the typical family is going to see $2,000 less in disposable income. So housing is a risk. You're always taking a risk when you make an investment. And the question is, are you more likely to take that risk when you know you're going to have a $2,000 hit the next year? I would say no. Mm-hmm. So the economy is doing okay, but Congress could still really screw it up.
Derek Thompson is the senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek Thompson, thank you.
Thank you.
In Italy tonight, everyone is eating the same thing for dinner. In a story of cheese and reclamation, we begin with the man who drew our attention to this great Italian moment, food writer Larry Olmsted, just back from a trip.
Well, it's Parmesan night in Italy, and they're trying a new thing where using the power of social media, they're trying to get people all throughout Italy to eat the same meal at the same time, sort of a virtual national sit-down dinner, but in people's own homes and to a lesser extent restaurants.
The reason for all this cheese bliss is a series of earthquakes earlier this year in the Parmesan region of Emilia-Romagna. The quakes toppled shelves of that world-famous cheese, which has aged for 2 years in giant five-story-high warehouses.
Yeah, I mean, equivalent of an apartment building. When you go in there, you're just looking up at the roof of this huge warehouse, and it's nothing but cheese as far as the eye can see. And the wheels are always the same size. They're huge. They look like tires. They weigh 80-something pounds. Several hundred thousand wheels of cheese fell off the shelf during the earthquake. So, long story short, a lot of cheese hit the floor.
Tonight, in solidarity with the cheesemakers of Parma, Italians are letting their Parmigiano Reggiano, as they call it, hit the saucepan.
All the good stuff comes from Parma. Prosciutto di Parma, which I think everybody loves. A lot of Italy's most famous brands are based there. Barilla Pasta, which everybody knows. Pasta and sauce. Parmalat, which makes like the Pomi box tomatoes. All of this comes from Parma. They just have a centuries-old tradition of great food. But the key is the cheese, the king of cheese.
So the Italians turn to their king of chefs. Massimo Bottura's restaurant in Modena, Osteria Francescana, is one of the world's best. And he designed the recipe on Italian tables tonight, using that delectable, incomparable cheese. The dish is called cacio e pepe, pasta with cheese and pepper. Chef Massimo Bottura.
First of all, the name, cacio e pepe. Cacio e pepe is a classic dish from the Roman cuisine that usually serve with pecorino and pasta. But we decide to change and to get cacio e pepe reflect to my territorio, no?
Larry Olmsted, who just dined at Bottura's restaurant, notes how the chef reinterpreted a classic recipe.
He switched out the pasta for a risotto because northern Italy is rice-based rather than pasta-based. And then he switched the cheese, which would normally be a local Roman cheese or often pecorino, he substituted the Parmigiano Reggiano to sort of tie the whole country together in this one fairly simple dish.
To me, it's the iconic cheese of the Italian cuisine. I believe in this. I believe in tradition. I believe in quality of the food you eat.
Of course, even though by now most Italians have finished their dinner and are perhaps sipping a glass of Fernet, I had to give Chef Massimo Bottura's risotto a try. So I invited a couple of Italians over. They came all the way from Rome, a little jet-lagged.
Buonasera.
Che bella casa.
Ah, grazie.
You know Silvia Pagioli, NPR senior European correspondent who came with her husband, Piero Bonastasso. Well, pretty soon, I let Silvia take over the kitchen.
What is the secret of good risotto?
To constantly stir it. You can't abandon it, really. It needs constant care.
Ooh, this looks divine.
And a meal's not complete without a salute.
Let's all toast.
Ching, ching.
Viva cacio e pepe.
Cacio e pepe.
E viva il parmigiano.
Viva parmigiano reggiano.
And this is probably the best alternative. If you can't get over to Massimo Bottura's restaurant in Modena tonight, then make your own. Risotto cacio e pepe.
It's like a dream, you know. You close your eyes, you smell it, and you travel with your mind.
I'm doing that right now. A little American pun, grazie a million. We're very, very happy.
I hope so, because, you know, we look at you as an example of democracy, an example of nation. We say thank you to you, too.
Well, we say it back, and the have a wonderful night.
Thank you very much. And it's going to be the biggest dinner ever.
You can see Chef Bottura's risotto from his restaurant, Osteria Francescana, at NPR.org. From NPR News, this is Weekends on All Things Considered. Guy Raz is away. I'm Jackie Leiden, and I'm away too. I'm out on the Bark River in southeastern Wisconsin on the most fantastic autumn day. We are surrounded by nothing but woods as far as the eye can see. This is the river that I grew up on. It goes right through Lake Negawicca, my childhood home. It's a beautiful backyard river with lots of history, and I've always wanted to explore it, but this is the first time I ever have.
Jackie, you're so vigorous as a paddler. I think we're going to have to cut the engine on the front a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Milton Bates is our canoe guide, but he's also the author of a new book called Bark River Chronicles, which floats the reader down all 70 miles of this winding southeastern river in detail. We're only doing 6 miles today.
This is a lovely spot here.
We're looking at birches and black walnut trees that have fallen into the river. And beyond the trees and the embankments on either side, it's really marshy. Where are we?
We are at Burnt Village. It's thought to have been the site of a Ho-Chunk village.
The Ho-Chunk are the indigenous tribe here.
You had all these villages for one reason, and it's because it was a very beautiful area to live. My name's William Quackenbush, and I'm the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Ho-Chunk Nation. The Burnt River area was a well-established winter camp.
It's the architecture of those Ho-Chunk winter camps that gave the Bark River its name.
The process would be that the women and the young adults would go there in the spring and cut the tree around the bark and then split that and peel them off. And they'd lay these in shingles on the ground, and they'd put a rock across the top of them so they would lay flat. And they'd let them sit there throughout the spring and summer. So when they would come and build their fall and winter chipotles, we call them, or living quarters, all this bark would be dried out, flat shingling, you know, and that's what they would use for these structures.
When white settlers came, they noticed the huts, the chipotles, and named the river. In 1832, they clashed. Milton Bates.
So we're talking about Wisconsin's major Indian war.
A Sauk warrior named Black Hawk swept through Illinois and Wisconsin territory, attacking settlers. So the U.S. government sent in the army to stop him.
General Atkinson was
up and down the bank trying to follow Blackhawk and his band.
But the mucky river bottom of the Bark was like quicksand for the horses, and it took several days before General Atkinson's troops could cross the Bark and pursue Blackhawk, who was scalping his way across the countryside.
Looking from a Native American perspective on the Blackhawk War, you know, it was quite one-sided.
Again, Ho-Chunk historian William Quackenbush.
There was ulterior motives as to why Blackhawk came over here, and there was ulterior motives to why this large government wanted to put him back, you know. And that said, we always say, you know, that it's all water under the bridge.
Okay, draw left a little bit. Okay, now we can just kind of work our way in. Probably you should be the first one to get out,
yep.
Jackie, but test it very carefully.
Get up before
my boot. Both of them, I only noticed the one.
Hey, at least it wasn't me, but our producer, Liz Baker, who face-planted into the muck, the boots sucked right off her feet. It gave us a really good idea of why it took General Atkinson so long to get his horses and carriages across the river to pursue Blackhawk. This river was carved during the Ice Age, when glaciers covered Wisconsin. That's why the swell and swale topography of Drumlin Hills and Kettle Lakes. I had to learn all this in geography class. But George Garvin says Ho-Chunks passed down stories from this period.
We have stories about saber-toothed tiger or mastodon, short-faced bear, and tells you we've been here for a long time. I mean, my father's father, my grandpa, he went to school up east, you know, and they saw a circus for the first time. And they ran across an elephant. They knew what it was right away, and it reflected on the days of the mastodon when he walked this earth, and didn't scare them, it didn't surprise them, they just said, oh. So that's what he looks like.
More recently, in the 1800s, the Bark was used to power the little gristmills all up and down the river, grinding corn and grain into flour and meal.
The mill ground here went all over the country, well, mostly to the east, of course. I'm Margaret, initial E, Zerwick. Don't forget the E. And my address is 500 Mill Road in Delafield, Wisconsin, United States of America.
This is the only private mill left on the Bark, and it happens to be just down the river from my childhood home. I've passed this place countless times, and I never before knew who lived there.
How long have you been in this house?
40 years. It was built in 1853.
Margaret E. Zerwick is almost 93. Her late husband, Kenneth, came back from fighting in France in World War II. He noticed that the only people to have electricity there during wartime were the millers.
And he said, I'm going to have a mill when I get home. And he came back and he bought it. It was so dilapidated, it was falling into the river.
Into the Bark
really,
River itself.
Really bending that way.
An engineer, Kenneth Zerwick, figured out a way to straighten out the four-story building.
So he put in those rods there through the house.
Anchored them to the telephone poles out in the yard.
And every so often he'd come out and pull it up a little bit higher.
Crank it up.
Pretty soon it got out. I think it's almost straight, but not quite.
And he also installed a turbine to generate power from the water, which provided all their household electricity until just a few years ago.
Could you hear the stones?
Oh, absolutely.
Turning?
It was right there.
What did it sound like?
How could I explain it? An old car. A truck. Let's put it that way, a truck. It would have been noisy to somebody, to you probably, but not to me, because those were dollars and cents that I was listening to. And when it stopped, you got out of bed and went down there to see what was going on, see what had stopped the water.
In a day and a half, I'd learned more than I'd ever known about the Bark. And standing up on the fourth floor of the mill house, I had a clear view of the river's graceful curves through the trees. A heron flew straight down to Margaret's mill race. The Bark is just a backyard river now, really, like so many others in America. But get into a canoe, and you'll be as surprised as I at how the water brings that history to life.
Kingfishers sailing off over our heads.
All on cue, even chattering.
For photos of our journey or to learn more about the new book, Bark River Chronicles, please visit our website, npr.org/barkriver. This story begins almost a decade ago in Brooklyn, when a kid who grew up fighting in the projects discovered another kind of power. After three felony convictions and time served at Rikers Island, Lemon Anderson didn't have many places to turn, except to his own words. He was the most popular poet on HBO's series Deaf Poetry Jam.
I'm from the County of Kings, where every day we know we're fortunate if we see another morning. We take our nieces, our nephews, put them under our wings, send them out in that world, hoping they keep that grass green.
Now, he's a Tony Award winner with a rave-reviewed one-man show called County of Kings. This past week, the independent documentary film Lemon aired on PBS. It's also been on the indie film circuit in theaters. Lemon Anderson joined us from New York. Welcome to the program.
Hello. It's great.
First of all, why do they call you that, Lemon?
Well, I'm a half-breed. You know, I'm Puerto Rican and Norwegian from descent, and I grew up born and raised in New York City, and I stood out amongst my friends and my community. I was very blonde-haired, white, and Lemonhead was the name that they gave me.
Both your parents are gone early in your life, and the relationship you have with your mother really informs your work. Tell me a little bit about her.
You know, my mother, Millie, she was extremely liberal from traditional Puerto Rican upbringing, you know, and so there wasn't salsa in my house growing up. There was disco music and zodiac signs on the wall. She brought me out to dance, and, you know, I was dancing with my mom at a young age. She taught me about soul and music, and she took me to parties in the street. Of course, there was a backlash to that kind of lifestyle. And she was getting high, and it was during the time where AIDS, you know, it was really bad. It came down on my mother. We led a whole different life once the AIDS epidemic came. And, you know, it's really about honor for me. You know, I owe it to my mother. She just put a lot of fire in me. So when I'm on stage and you see that side, it's really because I've been really blessed with a mother who taught me how to fight hard. And
would you mind sharing something from your stage piece about your mother?
My mother, Millie, is 5 feet full of tough tenderness, a rare, proudless Puerto Rican by way of a campo called Calle. Rigorous, rebellious, reckless one born second out of 7 children, chosen to sip the chilled chalice of the 1970s tough love supreme. But behind her bold boiling point, she loves me, so unconditional. So I say, okay, Millie, can we go to the Himalaya ride to dance? See, I knew she would say yes. That's the only thing I like about Coney Island in the summer anyway, because the beach is a mess hole of drunk lifeguards getting robbed under the boardwalk. The sand is like walking on hot coal. Plus, you got broken glass everywhere. So finally, when she couldn't get no more bronzed, Millie gets up off a floral house blanket, folds it into a red pleather oversized purse, and we're off to the Himalaya.
And the Himalaya is this great ride that she takes you to at Coney Island, which we see in the film. Lemon Anderson, when did you begin to connect with poetry?
I was in juvenile detention center, and I was in Rikers Island, and there was an anthology written by the inmates called The Pen, and I had a crush on a girl, and she left me when I was incarcerated, and I found this poem in this anthology that talked about having your heart broken and being incarcerated, so I related to the poem so much that I started to take on more poetry, and I found out that poetry was really beautiful at kind of putting these thoughts and words together when you couldn't do it yourself.
Well, you say in the film that you found a home in poetry when no one else would have you.
No, it really did. It showed up like a boss, right? You know, when you're looking for a job and you're knocking on all these doors and no one wants to hire you and you're tainted with a past. So poetry showed up. It felt like, all right, well, this is the only job that showed up for me, so I'm going to really show up for this job, and I'm going to really try to transcend poetry. And then I found out that poetry and theater have had a relationship for hundreds, if not thousands of years, so I became part of carrying that torch, you know.
If not thousands is absolutely right. I want to go back to your appearance in 2003. Russell Simmons produces Deaf Poetry Jam for Broadway. You're part of the team that wins at Tony. And this film follows you, and we don't know how it's going to turn out. Lots of ups and downs. And after the show closes, really kind of a downtime. What was it like to go from Broadway to being back on food stamps with your family and the projects?
It was tough on me more than actually losing my mom growing up, because I had children. And so this opportunity to write something new, write a new chapter in my life came when I started to develop this staged memoir. And next thing you know, I really found my kind of position in the sun, as I call it.
It's just amazing because I think that spoken word artists and poets, you know, rather like musicians, you can have these extreme highs and boy, then the next thing you know, you don't know what's going to happen. You've been really unlucky in your life, but you've also had some incredible luck.
Yeah, well.
Incredible connections. One of them is your wife. She comes through as a real heroine, your wife Marilyn.
Yes, I'm very lucky. I tell her all the time, everyone really loves her in this film. I've never seen the film, but I haven't seen the film. And people really love her, and I'm glad they see what I see at home. And you know, she's a normal, very, very normal woman with great strength, and sometimes we don't shine a light on that kind of lady in the world, right? You know, we're always looking for the lady who looks good on the red carpet.
So why haven't you seen the film?
I wanted to let the filmmakers tell their own story. No one touches me when I write my story unless I hire you to or I allow you to. And Laura Brownson and Beth Levison were really important. It's almost like I played dead as an artist.
So in other words, it's their movie, but it's your life.
Yeah.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on a play about Attica. And I took this great folklore hero named Dolomite and Staggerly, and I put him in this setting. 1971, right before the uprising, and it's just all imagination.
That's Lemon Anderson. There's a new documentary out about him called Lemon. Lemon Anderson, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Now for the nonfiction story of Peter Less, a man whose work inspires interpreters and translators everywhere.
He was a survivor of the Holocaust, and all of his family members, his parents, his siblings, his grandmother, were killed in Auschwitz.
That's Natalie Kelly. She's written a new book with Jos Secher called Found in Translation, How Language Shapes Our Lives and Transforms the World. She interviewed Peter Less at his home in Chicago about a year ago.
He went on to become an interpreter for the Nuremberg trials, which is where the Nazi war criminals were tried. And he was the voice of the masterminds of the Holocaust.
The defendants to plead guilty or not guilty to the charges against them. Hermann Wilhelm Göring.
Bevor ich die Frage des Gerichtshofes beantworte, ob ich mich schuldig oder nicht schuldig bekenne.
He was the one who was enabling them to communicate so that justice could be carried out, at least in the legal sense.
And as Kelly writes in her book, Peter Less interpreted for the very people who murdered his entire family.
To think about how hard it must have been for him to know that he was serving as the voice of the people who were responsible for the deaths of his family members really hit me. It really made me realize how difficult that must have been, because as an interpreter, you're constantly trying to remain neutral and detached and, you know, be impartial and convey that information in a way that is authentic and is loyal to the source.
Natalie Kelly knows something about interpreting. She's been in the business of translation for nearly 20 years. And in co-writing Found in Translation, she asked Peter Less how he was able to do what he did.
He basically just said you have to detach and you have to just act like a machine. You have to shut off your emotions. And you have to just do that job faithfully. And it's when you rise to the occasion, you know, that is the true sign of greatness, that he was able to do that under such circumstances. Not everybody could. You know, there were many interpreters for the Nuremberg trials who had to be dismissed because the testimony and the things they were interpreting were too difficult for them, too emotionally disturbing.
Natalie Kelly, writing about the history-making interpreter Peter Less in her new book, Found in Translation, How Language Shapes Our Lives and Transforms the World. She cries your name three times again. In the late 90s, Beth Orton set the music world buzzing with her singular sound, part folk, part electronica. But 6 years ago, she found herself at a life-changing juncture, pregnant with her first child and dropped from her recording label. She gave serious thought to leaving the industry altogether. Then Beth Orton started over. She began studying under one of Britain's premier folk guitarists, and that lit a fire under her once more. Now she's delivered perhaps the most critically acclaimed album of her career. It's called Sugaring Season.
Sugaring Season is the season when you tap the trees for sugar that turns into maple syrup, and it's a word that I've married someone from Vermont, so it's an expression that I kept hearing, and I was like, what is that? That's just so beautiful. And I like the idea that it's very, very first murmurings of spring, and you know, sometimes you can smell that spring in the air even though it's the dead of winter. You just get that vague glimpse of it, and there's that sense of hope that it brings. And I just thought, all in all, it just creates this wonderful sort of imagery of writing songs. It's for me, it's like, you know, it takes a lot of experience to make a little bit of sugar, and these songs these songs are my little bit of sugar, I think.
If I push your airway, you won't let me be the fastest. And that, oh, I've seen the light, it's in the harbor. Come on, pull me up the faster, back to the self-same day.
And I love it that you brought up your husband here. You're recently married, you have a yeah. child together, and that's Sam Amidon.
Yes.
And I'd like to ask you how you did use the time that you took away from touring and performing before this this record.
Yeah, I mean, I had my daughter Nancy, and then I kind of reconsidered whether I wanted to, I don't know, whether it was really something to continue with a child, you know. And then around that time, I met Bert Jansch, and I started working with him. Pretty much when I found out I was pregnant at 5.5 months, I stopped touring, and I just kind of ended up giving myself over to Bert, really. And I spent the next couple of years, you know, working with him, spending time at his house, learning about guitar, learning to sing with him. And I think, for me, that was quite satisfying.
Beth, Bert Jansch died about a year ago. Do you hear his influence on this record?
I do hear his influence on the record. In the most sort of basic way, he opened my mind to the ideas of open tunings and so on and so forth.
Which is what? Explain, please, what that is.
Well, it's like just messing around playing and just finding different tunings on the guitar, basically. And I mean, that's something else that, you know, Joni Mitchell's always done. She was always like messing around with tunings, making up her own tunings. And I think it became part of this idea of, like, how essential is it? Is this just another noise, or is this something beautiful? The purest part of myself came out. So I learned to sort of embrace my individuality, and if that meant writing a song on one chord over and over again, then that's what I do, you know? And I love that kind of, like, meditative quality of just kind of the repetition.
Which cut on this CD would you sort of say exemplifies that?
Magpie, definitely.
First
I
one.
Mean,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, essentially when I just started, you know, playing that round and round and round and round and round, for me it's like a mantra. It's like there's a mantra quality to it.
Magpie, magpie, I stand here watching the world go by. I wonder, do you ever question why? Oh, crow, crow, I'm sitting here wondering what you know. You see more of the day than I could dream.
You went to Thailand as a younger woman, right?
For, yeah.
Could you tell us about that, for a kind of meditative time, as you were speaking of?
Yeah, well, when I was 19, my mum passed away very suddenly. She got cancer, and she died very suddenly over a week. And I nursed her, and a huge thing in my life, very proud of that experience. I know that's a funny word to use, but it was actually one of the most amazing experiences of my entire life. Nursing someone who's dying was an absolute privilege. And when she died, she left us all £2,000 each. And it was a bit like a fable, you know, what did we do with our money? And I bought a ticket to Thailand with some friends. And then we all kind of peeled off. And me and this girl, she was like, I know of this place we could go and meditate. And I was like, meditation, what's that? Like, didn't know what she was talking about. Anyway, I went because it sounded like a laugh. After a while, I just opened up to it. It was like, you know, it was living in a monastery with nuns and monks, like, you know, and it meant eating food from 5 till midday and then fasting for the rest of the day. It meant we started meditating 15 minutes a day. walking and sitting, and it would then go up to half an hour, and then it went up to an hour walking and an hour sitting, and then it went up to basically 14 hours a day of meditation. I wasn't very well when I went there, and it was just extraordinary what happened. I went in, I was on steroids, I stopped all medication, stuff like that. I mean, it was just bizarre.
Do you use any of this today in your work, would you say?
Well, the strangest thing is it was one of the most profound experiences of my life, and I left there and I never meditated again. I was like, oh, well, I mean, I could do anything now. I can do anything, you know. Get my heart broken, I'll just meditate it away, it'll be fine. And then I started to play guitar and it became much more natural. And I think what happened was the discipline and the focus that I learned in the monastery became the same discipline and focus that I write with. She'll blow them stars up just like candles. Yeah, conduct the clouds to move a certain angle.
Beth Orton, you have gotten just lovely reviews. I mean, some of the best that you've ever had. And that's just got to feel so good, especially, you know, talking to Bonnie Raitt earlier this year, especially when one has stepped away for a while, as she also did, for personal reasons.
I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine last night, and she's an actress, and I know that when you make films and stuff, it's more of a team, but this was a team effort, you know. It was like, it was such an amazing band, such an amazing producer, and such a wonderful coming together of timing and people and falling into place. And so I do feel just so grateful for all of that. To hear what people are saying, and they're reflecting pretty much my experience of making this record, is really nice.
That's Beth Orton. Her new album is called Sugaring Season. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you so much and good luck to you.
Thank you.
For the week ending October 28th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. Our program is directed by Kenya Young and produced by Phil Harrell. The staff includes Lauren Silverman, Brent Bachman, Amy Held, Becky Hersher, and Brenda Salinas. Our interns are Acacia Squires and Barbara Sprunt. Special thanks to Liz Baker for her work on the Bark River story. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. At the operations desk, Tom Woodward. Our weekend web producers are Melissa Goh, Stephanie Federico, Krishnadev Kalamur, Steve Mullis, and Dana Farrington. Our reference librarian is Kim Oleski. Mathoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai, our senior producer. I'm Jackie Lydon. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for tuning in.